We think there'll be conflicts in strategies and certainly in taste, but we're hopeful that we can move beyond the existing stage of debate and learn from each other. In organizing this event, we made some important choices about our focus. We don't share, as organizers, one analysis of pornography or of what is needed or correct in alternate imagery. But we do, this is the organizing committee, all have agreement that there is a need for sex education and for new images. And we are a group of women who are concerned with the impact of censorship. We have chosen to concentrate on examining images, not on having the censorship debate, although we are, again, confident that it will arise. And we are not having, this is not a sexuality conference for women, although we would certainly welcome one organized in Vancouver for women only. These comments actually relate to why we chose to welcome men as well as women to the conference. And I want to address this because I'm sure some of you want to know. To our current knowledge, the majority of sexual images are made by and for male viewers. It seemed important to us to make available alternate work by women, both to women and to men. It seemed a bit, in fact, absurd to not allow men to look at feminist erotic images when pornography is available at your corner drugstore. We also think that there are men who are interested in understanding the critique of existing imagery and in struggling for new definitions of images and their experience as viewers, and also as artists, and it is encouraging to see men who are from the film and cultural community here. We're confident that men as well as women participants will respect the contributions of panelists and the process of debate. And I'm going to spend a few moments discussing process at the end of my remarks so that you know how things will work and how to change it if you don't like it. We feel that the conference's concentration on sexual imagery is critical right now in British Columbia. Although the women's movement has called for erotica and has expressed concern about the censorship of erotica, the definition of this term is either very vague or very specific, that is, equal sex between consenting adults. Within the next month, BC will have a new video censorship board, one with far-reaching powers and one that, in fact, sectors of the feminist movement have lobbied for quite intensively. The existence of this board could well herald a new era of conflict, certainly between feminists and between feminists, artists, sex educators, and the social credit government. Whatever one's opinion on censorship, it will soon be a reality for some artworks by women, and feminist women at that. We feel it's important for each of us to be clear about what, if anything, we are willing to defend against censorship, even if those decisions are pragmatic ones. For this reason, we've included a number of works by artists that are currently under attack in other contexts in Canada. Specifically Cindy Patton's readings from Bad Attitude, which is being blocked by Canada Customs, and Lisa Steele and Kim Tomczak's performance on Sunday that is currently being contested by the Ontario Censor Board. Having outlined this context, I want to spend some time suggesting a framework for this debate in more global terms, and the context I outlined is basically Vancouver and British Columbia, because the discussion of sexual imagery, in fact, has many layers and a very long history. The debates involve at least some of these factors, differing analyses of pornography, different views on the nature of psychological process, in particular of sexuality and connected to this, differing views on sexuality in general, different views on what ideology is, and by ideology, I mean ideas that explain or give meaning to the experience that we have on a day-to-day level and that give order to the social system that we're in. Also, within this debate, there are different ideas on art, mass communication, and popular culture, and their roles and their ability to influence behavior. There's certainly differences on strategy and both in dealing with pornography and also in dealing with sexuality. And the debate on porn encompasses a discussion of whether or not it's possible to produce images and that change the way we currently see sexuality and how to do that. There's also another debate, and that's on the nature of governmental power, in particular on whether or not women should call on the government to regulate sexual imagery. So there's a lot of different aspects of discussion that inform the various positions that people have. So I want to go through basically as much as I can each of these areas and try and give a little synthetic view of what some of those different positions are. And what you'll be hearing over the next 2 days is people speaking from one or another of those places in a fairly focused kind of way. So mine is synthetic, okay. First of all, on the analysis of porn, I guess the first position is porn is the theory, rape is the practice. And this view sees pornography as a literal depiction of male power. Male power in other forms is seen as sort of represented and culminating in the images of violent pornography. Catherine MacKinnon suggests that the fundamental organization of women's lives is around the male pursuit of control over women's sexuality. Physical force, rape, incest, sexual harassment, pornography, prostitution are not abuses of, to quote her, physical force, violence, authority, or economics. They are abuses of sex, end of quote. Women's sexuality is based on an ability to turn men on. It is a, quote, pervasive powerlessness to men expressed and reconstituted daily as sexuality. Pornography, then, this the end of the quote, pornography, then, is a central element in the power relations that keep women without control. Pornography itself is understood as a form of violent coercion, whatever the content of the actual image. Andrea Dworkin describes the ways that gender socialization teaches men to hate women and to see them as inferior. She describes porn as a major vehicle for that learning process. Research is then cited to back up these theories. The researcher evidence includes the presence of pornography at the site of violent crimes and desensitization research with men who have been convicted of sex crimes tests whether they respond to violent imagery or not. The idea that porn causes violence states that porn provides models for male behavior with women and that it teaches men to rape, batter, and to desire children. Added to this theory is the concept that porn is addictive. Once the male viewer begins to use it for pleasure, he craves stronger and stronger stuff, from pot to heroin. The implication of this theory is to target porn as a direct form of violence against women, making its prohibition a central strategic goal. Cultural feminism, or at least some elements in cultural feminism, expresses a kind of similar perspective, but discusses much less strategic issues than analyzing pornography. In this view, we live in essentially a Judeo-Christian society where evil or sin requires catharsis. Porn then becomes the flip side of Western dualism, that is dividing the world into the natural world and the world of reason. And male culture represents the conquest of the intellect, that is the masculine force, over nature, which is the feminine force. And the feminine is further represented by the body. The fundamental problem, then, is male opposition to nature and the struggle between the forces of, as Susan Griffin says, Eros, and the mind's attempt, the male mind's attempt to forget Eros, to suppress it through reason. Male culture is then destroying the world by turning it, or elements of it, into objects. And the voice of the feminine, or the natural, is silenced, so that the lies of pornography, which is sort of the epitome of male culture, are believed. Again, pornography is seen as determining reality. As well, by equating women's sexuality with natural or true values, male sexuality and identity can be seen as a destructive, rational force, and one that is almost by nature destructive through the last epoch of human history, through the entire history of Western civilization. Okay, the second position I would call when the picture of rape is more important than rape, we are fighting the evidence, not the problem. And that's a quote from Leslie Stern in Screen Magazine, a British feminist publication. This position describes sexist content in mainstream pornography, but questions the importance of porn as an issue. The interest in pornography is seen as being based on its depiction of sexuality, which in our culture has been made dirty and mysterious, private and inaccessible. Although sex is different for men and for women because of socialization processes, these women differentiate sex from sexism, and that's a very important difference between them and the women writing, I guess, from the Catherine MacKinnon, Andrew Dworkin perspective. Sexism is seen as occurring within sex, but sex itself can be freed from sexism and involve other experiences, such as pleasure. The anti-porn movement, according to this analysis, has confused the evidence with the problem. What is needed is to, quote, restructure the society so that removing violence against women is possible, not to get rid of the images of sexism or of violence. End of the quote. Proponents of this point of view quote studies by sociologists and psychologists as well. But these studies defy or deny the work of Dinnerstein and the American behaviorists. And Thelma McCormick is the Canadian sociologist whose study is to be noted here in terms of looking at the impact of pornography. These studies argue that there is no direct correlation between men watching pornography and then going out and enacting violence or the fantasies they see in porn against women. Now, those who argue this position feel that there is nothing inherent about men or women's sexuality and both can be changed. What porn does is to give form to experience and to reinforce existing ways of coding behavior, which is sexist behavior, within images. An aspect of this argument concentrates on the ways that the society suppresses sexuality by containing it within a market framework. And as a result of a generalized repression of pleasure and its replacement by commodities, there is a market for alienated hierarchical pornography, and it will exist as long as people cannot fulfill sexual needs through different kinds of human contact. Porn is thus a product of capitalism's ability to reduce all human need, including sexual needs, to marketable products. The problem is then not simply structures of sexism, but equally class-based economic structures. So let's, some women add that to the previous analysis. Okay, the third position I would describe is porn is about desire, not about sexism. This argument is made from several different points of view. It can be argued that pornography is the only available information on sexuality and pleasure within the culture, and that therefore it is both in demand and of value, that new images, different kinds of pornography, need to be produced. Pornography breaks through the traditional images of women as homemaker and at least acknowledges that women can have sex for pleasure, not only for child rearing. Some forms of pornography can be seen as being progressive in that they represent the sexual activity of minorities, in particular lesbians and gay men. And without these images, there would be no reference points for these sexual experiences because heterosexuality is so pervasive within our society. A more complex version of this argument proposes that scopophilia, that is sexual activity based on looking, is an inherent part of sexuality. And here I'm talking in psychoanalytic jargon, but I'm going to try and reduce the jargon. Looking at a fantasy image produced by someone else allows a loss of self. It allows the viewer to give up responsibility and feel pleasure without guilt, without having to actually construct their own fantasy. As well, people are curious about other sexuality. Looking is pleasurable as an exploration of the unknown, at the same time as it is reassuring through showing the familiar in terms of sexuality. There are particular elements of scopophilia that correspond to mainstream pornography. For example, the idea that objectification of the other person, is part of having a sense of oneself as differentiated from other people in the world. and that fragmentation, that is the breaking of the body into component images with concentration on genitals or sexual elements, is as much an element of psychological memories of pleasure as it is of the feminist or the perhaps radical feminist idea that it's an unconscious or conscious desire to destroy or represent the destruction of the female body. The gap between fantasy and reality within porn or within any sexual fantasy can also be seen as giving permission for pleasure where activity is taboo. And this theory also assumes that sexual desire is an inherent, or can assume that sexual desire is an inherent biologically formed force, but one that is then formed in specific ways through social relations that shape the way that we act out our sexuality within the boundaries of the physical possibilities of our bodies. Okay, the fourth position I would call, I'm proud to be a Christian in a Christian country. And I have to tell you that that is a direct quote from an intervention that was made on November 20th with a meeting with Brian Smith in Vancouver on pornography. And the person I'm quoting is a woman named Diana Cause. And it is very much another position in this debate, and one that has been voiced clearly, certainly in the United States and now increasingly in Vancouver. And I have to tell you that some feminists in the audience clapped for this woman after she spoke. And I found that one of the sort of more frightening experiences. And I've been trying to give different people's approaches, but that's my opinion. I mean, it just blew me away. But anyhow, Mrs. Cause outlines the following issues of concern. Pornography places, quote, family life at risk. It mocks and degrades, painting an unwholesome and animal-like version of human behavior. And I mean, we can look at animal-like and say, yes, you know, some of us might think that porn images reconstruct women's experience as being animal-like. But this woman meant animal-like because she thought that it referred to human evolution, and she is a creationist. It describes, quote, perverse pleasures. It breaks down morality through frequent exposure to sexual imagery. It corrupts children. Porn in all forms must be eliminated. She prayed that her daughters and sons would not be attacked by porn-addicted perverts. In agreement with her at the meeting were a number of speakers who voiced concern that anarchy would reign if there was freedom of speech, like full freedom of speech, liberty without law. And this is the right-wing position on pornography. In it, porn undermines, above all, the traditional role of women within the family, promoting sexual liberalization. And the statement of this monolithic concept of Christian values, I think, can be taken as a promise of the kind of enforced change in sexual norms that real women, like Mrs. Cause, might want to see happen. So having sort of outlined some of the positions on pornography, I want to now talk about sexuality. As must be clear by now, these different attitudes towards pornography incorporate very different views on sexuality. And again, I want to briefly outline this debate. First of all, sex is a male construct. That's the first position. This argument states that men control women's labor both in the workplace and within the home. This latter work, that is domestic work, includes reproduction and thus sexuality. Male control is manifested through degradation, violence, and the correlation of female passivity. This argument would basically say that it's difficult or impossible for women to escape from victimization as sexual beings, especially within heterosexual relationships. The second position I'd characterize as sex as ideological battleground, that is, a place for a struggle of concepts and ideas. In this argument, we would look at how society sees sexuality as a kind of supreme and secret truth, as parallel to nature in some way, but in an alienated form. Sexuality is defined within the culture by ideas as a separate world, in some ways like art and culture itself. It's kind of interesting. And it's seen as existing outside of politics and reality. In reality, then, sex and sexuality are products of changing factors, though. Structures within the family, economic and social conditions, ways of controlling and shaping sexuality, often by the government or state, the state in general, political movements and their ideas, popular culture, which often expresses resistance from groups within the society against existing forms of sexuality. Foucault, in particular, centered on sexuality as historically created. Sexuality is a relatively new idea, in fact, in contrast with the human body, which has sensations, functions, and pleasures, not rules and regulations. These rules, that is, morality, can be seen here, are created by social structures and ideas, and various forces shape sexuality. These become a form of regulating or controlling what forms of sexuality occur and how the body is used within sex. So, for example, censorship does this. The creation of sexual categories, for example, by psychiatry, the enforcement of these categories, and an example of this is the incarceration of sexually active female teenagers within psychiatric hospitals or juvenile homes. And certainly the concepts of what's normal or what's abnormal, all of these are social creations. This theory is important in several ways. It questions the idea that there is some kind of sexual norm that is anything but socially determined. Psychological structure in this case is the product of historically created maleness and femaleness, which once created can be undone. Rather than there being an actual history of sexuality, there is only a history of ways that societies have described and dealt with specific sexual practices and the category of sex itself. This position, when extrapolated, can challenge the assumption that there is one form or experience of female or male sexuality and sexual identity, that is, all women are victimized, all men are rapists, that kind of polarization, instead of continuums and breaks from the norms that are equally normal. In other words, if we see sexual identity as being affected by family structure, censorship, and so on, then there are conflicts within one individual's identity. People are not whole beings. They are fragmented and contradictory instead of male or female. That is, as a woman, I have masculine elements, feminine elements, as we might describe them in other terms. As well, sexuality and the expression of subcultural identity in particular. By subcultural identity, one could refer to the gay or lesbian communities, is an area of struggle. It's not fixed. That is, it's not sort of in place forever within patriarchal structure, but always changing and shifting based on struggles, which are political struggles for power and struggles for cultural expression, amongst other things. So the fight of the gay or lesbian movement, let's say, to enshrine civil rights within Canadian law, if that was done, that would in fact really shift the dynamic around the social space for sexuality, for gay and lesbian sexuality within Canadian society. That's an example of what I mean by that. Okay. The next position I describe is the sort of feminist film theory point of view, that is the feminist analysis of voyeurism. This analysis centers on the ways that sexuality is read through images in specific and how images are read in general. It defines scopophilia or voyeurism as an actual form of sexuality. It draws on a number of theorists, structuralists, neo-Freudians, and so on in order to do this, and describes the ways that gender training an existing language is central to how we see and what we see, or what we think we see. For men, then, the function of looking is a means to establish power. It becomes a way of establishing power. Central to this theory is the understanding that women are located in patriarchal, that is, male-controlled society as the other. Women are excluded. Women are seen as being, for the most part, forced to operate outside of male language, male-controlled masculine language. The language that forms sexual imagery is not the language of, and this is important, of real women and real men interacting. That is, it's not a realistic image of what is really happening, but it is of the male unconscious, that is, the suppressed unconscious part of the psyche. There is a continuity between the ways that men see as well in this theory. That is, there is a masculine sort of pole and a feminine pole. Technically speaking, the man transfers his pleasure, his phallic pleasure, based on his penis, to pleasure at watching others be sexual. Laura Mulvey, a feminist film critic, has noted that even in non-pornographic images, women are relentlessly turned into sexual objects for the benefit of the male viewer, in her perspective. The male gaze, and the word gaze will reoccur as I go through this description, so that's the male looking position, as it is called, is comprised of several parts. These are the point of view of the camera, and there's usually a man directing and a man behind the camera. The look of men within the script towards women in the film, that is, the way that the man in the actual structure of the narrative looks at the woman, is a voyeuristic gaze. And the viewer, as well, is assumed to be a male viewer, and the whole structure operates for his pleasure. The problem with the male gaze is then that it carries the power to act and to possess, because really looking at something and enjoying it is not a problem in and of itself. It's what happens with that process of looking at women. And the problem as well is that the female gaze carries only the ability to be passive or to identify with the male point of view. So women are in a real bind, according to this theory. The sexualization of women within the image eliminates, its function is to eliminate men's fear of castration and of the vagina, which gives pleasure, and has been rejected by men in favor of male power, and also the fear of the womb with the power to be creative. It's power to create life, in fact. The male viewer then fetishizes the woman in the image, identifying her with his penis and pleasure, and turning her into an object without personal power. Voyeurism then becomes control through domination. Now, in this analysis, all sexual imagery is designed for the male viewer. Women are excluded or forced to collaborate in their own objectification. Okay. The last position on sexuality I would describe as basically gay and lesbian theories, more sociological theories and psychological, on heterosexism. Lesbian feminism has contributed an important structural analysis of the family as excluding and containing homoeroticism. The sexual division of labor within the family teaches children traditional roles, punishing those who do not conform with male and female gender coding. Not only is there a division of labor around work, but there is also strong training around sexual identity. Despite this, individuals slip through the cracks, so to speak, when the pressures to conform to gender roles are either reversed or looser than the traditional norm, or when the pressures to stop loving and identifying with the parent of the same sex somehow are not in place. Lesbians and gay men are the products of this process of slippage. Corresponding with the strong socialization towards heterosexuality is a corresponding lack of information, models, and images of same-sex relationships within the society, and certainly of sex. So there's no images of people making love of the same sex. There's also the view that the discussion is distorted, and this is another sort of footnote of mine, by the centrality of this issue, of the issue of pornography, when in fact sexuality should be the issue at hand, and the ways that sexual repression and misery is perpetuated by capitalism. So Wilhelm Reich, for example, expressed concern with repression and its role in developing authority structures. He saw a direct relationship between authoritarian ways of teaching and experiencing sexuality, and the ways that that made individuals open, particularly people without power, open to manipulation by fascism. A disciplinary society controls its population in general. It controls the body, and the state's role is to help to construct norms that are exclusive norms. So the connection to sort of the commodity base of sexual pleasure within the society is an added factor to this position. And the videotape, I think, the first tape that we saw last night kind of laid out that kind of analysis. Okay, the next debate, moving right along here, is the debate on ideology. And an important underlying set of assumptions in this debate are varying ideas about ideology. That is the quote, system of representations, myths, ideas, images, or concepts that people hold. It's Walter Benjamin. Briefly, these divide into the following, and this is quite synthetic. First of all, the idea that the ruling group in society, class or strata, has complete control over the production of ideas, of ideology. Secondly, a different position is the idea that ideology, and by this I would include art, pornography, mass culture, is a direct mirror of the society structure. An added element of this is the concept that there are some forms of ideology that show the true nature of the society, such as some art forms, correct or Marxist, this is sort of from the older school of Marxism, correct political theory against the false ideology of the ruling classes in society. And so you've got a true ideology which embodies the suppressed interests of the oppressed, and a false ideology which exists to sustain social control. And then you can see art or pornography or some kinds of erotica as sort of falling into one or another category, some being correct and some being incorrect. Thirdly, the idea that ideology is an area of struggle, that it is generated both by ruling strata within the society and in the process of daily living, and that these ideas expressed perhaps as subcultures, as class identity and so on, are in conflict. And if you look at ideology this way, then the production of a variety of images of resistance and the fact that these images will be different from each other and have different aspects to them and may in fact be in conflict themselves makes some sense. Okay. Now, connected to the debate on ideology is an analysis of the relationship between images and the reality in which we live. And this basic debate emerges as whether or not people believe that pornography is causal. That is, does it cause behavior? It also emerges in strategies that artists and the porn industry choose to use in order to show sexuality. And basically, there are two opposing opinions on the relationship between images and reality. The first relies on behaviorist psychological theory and believes that and also a belief that ideas can instigate, can make people want to act, as opposed to the structures around them in combination with ideas, and also a focus on analyzing content. And basically, this position says that images directly influence behavior. In this view, violent pornography inspires violence. And in this view as well, new sexual images must conform directly to a new